girlfriend or your wife. You be in a melancholy mood or something. Well, you just want to hear some blues. Then you just go in and relax your nerves. Blues is something that relaxes your nerves.
Got the blues? Need your nerves relaxed? Well, then tune in to Code Blue every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 p.m. for all kinds of blues and all definitely from the heart. That's every Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Code Blue.
Are you the second man? He have been prosperous, making lots of money. Well, I mean, when his money's all gone, what else is left but the blue?
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. With the recent inauguration of U.S. President Barack Obama, much has surfaced about Obama's rhetorical skills, the ability to captivate and inspire audiences through the power of speech. This has led even some writers to describe him as the greatest orator of his generation. Now, although Obama draws on a rhetorical heritage spanning from Abraham Lincoln to Martin Luther King, the history of public speaking can be traced to ancient times. In ancient Rome, the art of speaking in public was called ars oratoria, a person who was skilled in speaking well, someone who employed a perfect eloquence to defend either public or private causes. This profession, even in Roman times, was something held by politicians and lawyers. My guest today, Professor Benjamin Perrin from the Faculty of Law, would agree with me that the power of the spoken word does not only influence the outcome of a legal matter. Brilliant rhetorical force can also set precedents, change statutes, and ultimately change the course of history. This is Prof Talk. Professor Benjamin Perrin is a shining example of someone whose oratory skills have influenced many to rethink how we understand global human rights in the context of our own lives. Today and next week on Prof Talk, you will hear Benjamin Perrin up close. First, an intimate conversation with him about his life, and next week a speech that he delivered to the BC Human Rights Coalition and the United Nations Association in Canada on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, last December 10, 2008. Professor Perrin joined the UBC Faculty of Law in August 2007 as assistant professor. His teaching and research interests include domestic and international criminal law, international humanitarian law, and human trafficking. We began a conversation about his beginnings, what first drew him to the study of law, and what ultimately motivated him to dedicate his life to the protection of human rights.
The place where I think I really got started thinking about some of these big issues that I do work on, like human trafficking, child sexual exploitation, war crimes, those are my areas I have as a day job now. I wonder, you know, where this all got started. And there's a few things, I think, when I was young that really affected me. One was going through the scrapbooks of my grandfather, who was a peacekeeper in the UN. He also fought in World War II. And he was a journalist. And he, in addition to being a fighting soldier, used to write stories for the military and had a photographer who went with him on a lot of the operations that he was on, and including in places like Cyprus and the Congo and that in Korea as well. So I got to see the world through his scrapbooks from a very young age and had a real interest and fascination in getting abroad and seeing some of the people and situations that he had come across as a Canadian peacekeeper. That, I think, really got me thinking about the world beyond my own neighborhood. At the same time, I have a family that has been, you know, very active in the local community and from a young age in my early teens, working as a babysitter at a women's shelter. So for some of their kids when they were going for group therapy, when I was, you know, 14 or 15, I would come down and babysit these, you know, young kids. And I got exposed to the problems that we had in our own backyard as well. So at one stretch, you know, my mind was looking abroad, but at the same time seeing in my own local community that there were people who were facing really tough circumstances, and that there were people behind the suffering, that this didn't happen for no reason, that there was, either in the case of the armed conflicts, that there were people who were waging wars in ways that were affecting civilians, and causing them all kinds of untold suffering, and that in our own communities there were, in particular, men who were causing violence against these women and children and often sexually abusing them, and that these problems had a face. That's really, after thinking about this for a long time, where I think my interest began, and it's been a real common theme in the work that I do, which is recognizing that as big as these problems are, in Canada and globally, if there are people and faces behind the problems causing them, there have to be people who are willing to be part of the solution, or at least to mitigate the harm that's suffering out there. So that's been a real eye-opener for me as I think about that. It's also one of the reasons why I do a lot of speaking and lecturing in high schools, in university classes to community groups. It's not just about getting out research and research dissemination. That's how this type of thing gets talked about, and often talked about in very dry clinical terms in a university environment. But I know for a fact myself and a lot of my colleagues, not just in the law faculty but other departments of the university, view their role as academics as either people trying to at least help understand the world better to help improve it, or on their own as a policy entrepreneurs. We have very high, you know, ethical and academic standards in the work that we do, but at the end of the day, we're not neutral social agents. We are out there trying to do something. And in my case, it is trying to hold accountable perpetrators or war criminals, human traffickers, and child sex offenders. And that is really at the core of law being just one tool to achieving that end. Now, getting back to where this started, before we were talking a bit about where my work started on this issue in Southeast Asia and Cambodia. That's been a real interesting piece of this, and where a lot of my work on the human trafficking issue in particular got started. In 2001, a group of friends and I got together. We were in the third year of our undergraduate degrees, and we were thinking about what we wanted to do with our lives, and realized that we were going to have this summer that was free before we started full-time jobs, graduate school, families, you name it, and wanted to do something meaningful with that. And I started out initially just me looking for organizations I could go and work for and intern at and begin to work on some of these bigger international issues, and actually not finding a lot of organizations, Canadian ones in particular, that were working on a lot of these very pressing global issues that were in the news and I was just beginning to hear about. And that really surprised me. People began saying, well, you should just, you know, the government will look after this issue. You should be looking there. And there was nothing in terms of action from the government either. So we began very ambitious and, you know, in our youth, probably overambitious goal of trying to actually go about ourselves building some contacts with local organizations in Cambodia and Canadian businesses working there, people who would be willing to work with us to try to deal with the issue of human trafficking in that country. And we were just a very small group of people, very different backgrounds, people from medical backgrounds. I had, at the time, an international business background. And all had a sort of similar goal of attempting to make a positive contribution. So we built those contacts, we raised the funding locally, we did our homework, and we went there. And the first month, all we did was learned. We offered help where it was wanted, and just built some trust in the local shelters where a lot of these young women and young boys were rescued after being enslaved in these brothels in Cambodia. And we came with ideas that we'd found through research to how to maybe improve the situation. And some of them were, you know, clearly not going to work and weren't relevant. But there were one or two that made a lot of sense. One that I'll give you as an example was a education program for at-risk children in rural villages where traffickers recruit kids and spread a lot of, you know, lies about the kind of jobs they'll have and the money that their families will make. And these villagers were never finding out about what had happened to these kids afterwards in any sort of systematic way. There were some programs to warn their parents, but there were no programs to educate the children themselves. And the reason we really decided that we needed to implement this program one day is in our first month, we met this young girl. She was about 9 years old. And when we were speaking with her about what had happened to her through a translator and got to the end of our discussion and asked her what her plans were for the future, and we said, do you want to go back home to your family? And she quieted right up and she wouldn't speak. And we asked the social worker there, so, well, what's the matter? And she said, well, this girl doesn't know where her parents are. She knows their first names only, mom and dad, and the village she lives in, she doesn't know the name of it. She has no hope of going back to that family that she's lost. There's no child find in Cambodia. It's not like here in Canada where there'd be a whole system in place to find this family and reunite them with their child. So this young girl from this isolated community who's been victimized by countless men sexually, it has no prospect of ever going home to find her family. So when we set out to launch this prevention program, we also included in it a place for these children to learn the names of their villages and to learn the names of their family names of their own families. I remember my younger siblings. As a joke, we used to ask them when they were that age, you know, what city do you live in, and what country, and what street? And nine times out of ten, at that age, they mix it up. Right? In Canada, you know, we teach children in school their phone number. That is part of our public education system for children's safety. If that's not part of your program in a country like Cambodia, where there are actual predators out there seeking to abduct and also to purchase or trick children into the sex trade, they really have no chance if they're eventually rescued. So that was an example of a program where we had the funding to pay for the program. We used some local groups to help develop the program. We had a Canadian artist who designed the brochure. It was meant for people who were illiterate. You could tell through the pictures and the activities in the booklet what the message was. And then met up with a group of young Cambodian professionals, late teens and early 20s, who were the ones who went out and actually implemented this thing in their local language. And we reached about 10,000 children that first year. And the following year, it was so popular, we funded another 80,000 to reach out to these remote villages. And they weren't just sort of picked at random. We did the homework with the local groups to figure out where these villages were and which were most vulnerable and where had traffickers been recruiting from, and were very targeted. That was a very efficient use of our time and money in a very high-impact way. And those are the types of programs that we saw an opportunity as a group of young Canadians to make a contribution, not to say we knew what was best, but identified that there was a gap there and began to solve it. So there were prevention programs like that. We did some work with rehabilitation of victims and a small business training program for some 16 to 21-year-olds that I helped run as a business student at the time, teaching them some small business skills. They'd learned trades, things like sewing, being restaurateurs, but they never learned about basic things like keeping your business money separate from your personal money, and a lot of the businesses were failing. After the program, they saw their success rates going up. And then near the end of our trip there is our last week, I got a phone call very late in the night from who I thought was going to be my employer after I finished that degree, consulting firm in Toronto. And they said, you know what, the dot-com bubble, this technology industry thing, has tanked. People probably remember that, right? A lot of people lost their jobs. And they said, these management consultants, we've all offered you guys jobs. You're going to have to wait at least a year, and we'll still give you the job then if you want it. But you don't have a job when you come home. And that really shocked me. I'd planned on doing that for a few years and going into law afterwards, but that really catapulted me into thinking, what am I going to do with my life here? And knowing that I didn't have enough skills to really do what I wanted, which is to, at the end of the day, go after some of the offenders and try to strengthen the laws against them and the enforcement of those laws. So it was then that I decided to start my legal career and have continued working on this issue in varying capacities ever since, while picking up some other issues and making some contributions elsewhere too. But that's where my initial introduction to human trafficking and the child sex trade got started. A very high impact personal way. Well, it's funny, you know, a lot of law students that I teach here at UBC, and when I was a student at McGill and U of T in law schools there, the overwhelming majority of students come in wanting to change the world. They come in wanting to and specifically work on human rights, social justice type issues, international issues. The overwhelming majority do not end up doing that when they graduate. They end up doing other jobs. Well, why? Because these other jobs usually pay better. There's more of them, and there is a huge mechanism in marketing around that. Canada needs lawyers to do all kinds of things. We need lawyers to do tax law, real estate law, corporate law, you name it. But it's astounding to me how many students who I get phone calls from now, colleagues of mine back then who are now practicing in areas of law they didn't want to really work in, asking, how do I get back into some of those issues and areas that I initially started out my law career wanting to do? And it's really hard to make those transitions. So I had to make a tough decision in law school. I had offer to go article at one of the big corporate law firms. It was a great firm. It would have been a fantastic career in Toronto. And I turned them down without having a safety net. I said no. I was the only person to do it. People were coming by saying, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. So you have some big secret plan? And are you going to go work in New York for an even bigger firm? And I told them, no, I don't know what I'm going to do yet, but I want to, you know, stick with this goal I had of working in international issues and human rights issues and in ultimately issues of transnational crime that do impact Canada as well. And people just couldn't believe it. So I had lucky to have a very supportive family and a partner and began working on what would I do. And so the plan eventually developed, decided to go to graduate school, which I did at McGill. They have a very strong international criminal law and human rights program there, which I took part in, and it was there that I got interested in working in international criminal law and war crimes as well, and spent an internship as a summer intern working in the Hague in the Netherlands at the UN War Crimes Tribunal there, and worked on some of the war crimes cases against people in the former Yugoslavia and assisted some judges there. And then at McGill at the Sierra Leone Special Court, an African conflict in a hybrid tribunal, worked on that for 2 years and helped coordinate a team of students there. That's also where I really got interested in the prospect of being an academic and beginning to understand what it could mean to be a law professor, that it's not a teacher. A lot of people think of it as a teacher. There certainly is part of that, but even in our classes, it's not a pure lecture format. It's a dialogue. It's a debate. It's intended to engage people, and then of course the seminars really to delve deeper into issues. And it's been fascinating to see that class type time get used in a engaging way, but also seeing these programs where students are working on real live issues. I saw that at McGill, and it's something now which I've brought to my academic career here at U of T, directly involving students in ongoing current international issues. It's really frustrating for students, I think, and a lot of faculties who spend a lot of time and hard work on their research papers or projects and then don't see those pieces of work go anywhere. So after that experience in grad school and really deciding to focus on this, I completed a clerkship at the Supreme Court of Canada so that I would be called to the bar, and that happened in Ontario, and began looking at law schools that were in Canada that would be interested in having someone build up a bit of an international human rights law and criminal law program. And UBC, lo and behold, was advertising, and I grew up in Calgary. Wanted to come back out west, had visited Vancouver but never lived here, and during my week in January when it was minus 30 in Ottawa, came out here for an interview and it was, you know, zero. That sold me. The weather alone, no, of course not, but it certainly helped. The Vancouver Aquarium did too. I love whales. I like being on the coast, and the faculty was just really warm and embraced the kind of work that I wanted to do here. So I've been here at UBC for about a year and a half now, and have really enjoyed getting the work that I've been doing, taking on a bit of a new role and having a whole great group of students to work with on it.
I then began a conversation with Professor Perrin about the strenuous challenges that he encountered in his work in the area of human trafficking. I was curious, how do lawyers balance their ability to perform well with the emotional and disturbing challenges that come with taking on such cases as child prostitution and modern slavery?
Yeah, it is. It's really tough. I mean, there's certainly times where you don't even think about it. It's your day job when you work on these kind of projects. I mean, last week I realized that I was feeling less stressful related to the content of what I was working on, because for that week I was editing some work that I was doing related to war crimes. That was a break from working on the stories of human trafficking victims. So that was a bit of a horrible realization that was the way to get a break from the work, was by focusing on another tragic situation. So clearly that's not the way to do this work. There's not a lot of support that you get as a student, for example, in choosing to go into an area of law like this. That's something where, we see in other areas to some extent, caring for the caregivers. So people who are directly working on this sort of problem, for example, who are working in the Canadian Centre for Child Protection, where I've visited their offices in Winnipeg. These people are in their 20s and 30s, and their job is looking at horrific images of children being sexually abused and classifying them in a database so that they can track them and eventually, hopefully, shut down these websites and convict someone. Those people have to shift out of those jobs routinely, and there's special protocols, and there's, counseling and all that sort of stuff that's in place for them, and they've got a very good system in place to help those people deal with it. Now, we don't look at that kind of imagery or anything like that on a daily basis, but there's nothing really comparable that's in place. So one of the things that that I do with our students is for them to make sure they know that there's support for them. And the best way that we do it is through talking about these cases with each other. And I really got to know that as a mechanism for dealing with the trauma that you're witnessing and often seeing fairly serious evidence of, is through working at the War Crimes Tribunal in Holland. And that's how people deal with these issues there. It's by having colleagues who you can talk and be honest about what you're going through. There are definite moments when you're desensitized to the kind of issues you're dealing with. And I've come to know over the years that you cannot possibly predict which stories or moments will be personally difficult for you to deal with. It's not always the most traumatic cases that from the facts. It can be a very small detail which can make you feel like, well, this is really difficult. I don't know if I can keep going on. But I think it's important for people who do work in this area. You see it in people who have burnt out, working in various professions, who work in very very tough issues, to realize that you're still a human being when you're doing this work. As much as you're a professional and you're somewhat detached from the day-to-day of the stories you're reading, if it's not having an impact on you, it's maybe time to be picking a different issue or career to deal with. So one of the main ways that I deal with it is, you have to find good outlets for yourself to enjoy life. And Vancouver is a fantastic city for that. So I've been enjoying doing that and certainly making time to do things. You don't read this material before you go to bed, if you're working on it 24/7, you obviously can be impacted more seriously than not. So that's a real unexplored part of academic life, that for people who do empirical research, the overwhelming focus is on the subjects that you're dealing with and interviewing, and protecting, as we should be, concerns related to the trauma of them telling their stories. There's nothing really at all in that process that looks at the researcher and the difficulties or challenges that they may face from dealing with these issues. So that's been an interesting piece of the puzzle. And fortunately, there is stuff in place if you were ever to need it. But the level of issues that we're talking about are, things like you come back from a research trip and you've dealt with these cases for a long time, and then the next morning, lo and behold, the case that I'm teaching in criminal law happens to be a case involving a sexual assault on a boy, and that is the last thing that I want to be, talking about or reading. So things like that can happen to you where you just wonder, wow, is this really all that the world has to offer? And you have to remember that in this type of research, you are actively looking for the worst of the worst, and you're going to find it. But I really think there's a real strong moral obligation to do this kind of work in a university. it's clear that no one else is doing it. They, governments don't have the time and resources to focus on this. They're also not independent. They don't inform the public to the extent that they could or should about these cases very often. It's taken us prying information out through access to information requests and, in some cases, complaints to the information commissioner, threats to go to court for judicial review to pry records out of government departments to tell us what's really been going on in our own country. That's been the most remarkable piece of this, is how much data and information there is. But the best analogy I can come up with is it's like a puzzle. And all these pieces of the puzzle for Canada's involvement in human trafficking are spread throughout the country, and they're hidden. And you have to physically go to these places and meet the people and build trust and talk to them and then begin to see the full picture. And we're only slowly beginning to see that happen. And myself, I read a lot of how Canada's been viewed historically as well for various issues, and this is one where we've really fallen behind. Martin Luther King Jr., when he came to Canada, said that Canada was the North Star on their long road to freedom for African slaves, right? We were the Underground Railroad to Canada in the 1800s. 30,000 freed slaves came to Canada seeking freedom, and they found it here. And now it's just horrific to see that we've become a haven for modern-day slavery that's happening under our own noses. And for me, it's the gravity of this crime and human rights violation that really requires our response. We're beginning to get an idea for the size and scope of it, but we're not criminologists. We're not going to be coming up with a statistic or a number, which the media is always, you know, wanting to have for many reasons. But we've confirmed this is a reality in Canada, both for foreign victims as well as Canadians. And we're getting to a level of detail which is actionable, where governments, NGOs, and the public can act upon. For example, before our study, the only information we could find was Canada is believed to be a destination for women from Asia and Central and Eastern Europe. Well, that's a pretty broad category of people. That includes millions, if not billions of people. That is nothing remotely close to actionable for immigration or border officials or NGOs. So what we've got to, at least to the point now, is we know what the top four countries are. China, Romania, the Philippines, and Moldova came out as the top four countries. And not the top four among many. Those four alone account for about three-quarters of all of the suspected Canadian cases of foreign trafficking. We also have got to the point of knowing specific organizations in Canada that are involved in trafficking Canadian women and girls. It's no longer the big bad traffickers who we don't know who they are in the shadows. We're actually at the stage of knowing who these groups and individuals are. So it's got to that level of very actionable information, which is what our goal was. And our ultimate findings are going to make hopefully some changes, some recommendations. William Wilberforce, if people have watched the movie Amazing Grace, you know, it's the anniversary of the abolition of slavery in the British Empire, just celebrated last year. And what he said in one of his more powerful speeches trying to end slavery back in the 1800s was, once you've seen all this, you can choose to look away, but you can never again say that you didn't know. And that's ultimately the goal of what we're trying to do, is shedding light on a very dark area in Canada and some streets and some areas and some issues that people haven't known about and some people may not want to know about. But it always surprises me how many people do care and do want to see more action on these problems. That's what's very inspiring, is seeing these slow steps being taken and some very early signs of success.
Prof Talk on CITR 101.9 FM. You were just listening to Professor Benjamin Perrin from the UBC Faculty of Law. Next week on Prof Talk, you will hear a recent speech of his that he delivered to the BC Human Rights Coalition last December. If you would like to send us feedback, you can at proftalk@gmail.com or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farah Khan. Thank you for listening.
On February 8th at 8 p.m., the Chan Center and the Push Festival present New York City's avant-garde ensemble, Bang on a Can All-Stars, part rock band, part amplified chamber group, performing works by Brian Eno, and from Sonic Youth, Thurston Moore. And on February 15th at 8 p.m., the Chan Center and Kickstart Disability Arts and Culture present Waits, a live performance with Lynn Manning, a riveting one-man play told by actor-storyteller Lynn Manning about how his life changed forever when a bullet, shot in a crowded Los Angeles bar, robbed him of his sight. The show opens with BC singer-songwriter and recent Canadian Aboriginal Music Award winner Krista Couture. Tickets at Ticketmaster, student ticket price.